I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Spring has finally sprung and bird song is increasing every day. Joining us for bird news, ornithologist Vernon Lux, who's joining us on the phone from home as he's moving a tad slowly this morning. Good morning, Vern.
Good morning, Mindy.
So you took a spill on your bike yesterday.
Yes, I very cleverly got disassociated from my mountain bike and went flying. And after spending most of the day at the hospital, the good news is I only broke one rib, did not puncture any lungs, and I'm going to have a little trouble breathing and a little pain for a couple of weeks, but I'll be right as rain before you know it.
All right, so we shouldn't try to make you laugh today.
Though. Right, laughing is bad. Laugh. No jokes today, because okay. Laughing is the worst.
All right, so let's talk about the weather. It's finally warmed up a bit, and I'm sure that's welcome news for migrating birds, but also the winds have picked up.
Mid-April is amazing. Yesterday was just, that was like the Southwest Express, especially temperatures inland. And I got home from the hospital, I looked at the mass bird and just saw floods. It was like the floodgates were open with migrant birds. Little chipping sparrows showed up all over the place, ruby-crowned kinglets, the first towhees, indigo buntings showed up, just the spigots open, and here they come. So this... Mm-hmm. Yeah, the next month is really a spectacular time for birding.
Right, and so when we have some windy or stormy weather like this, when these, like I'm thinking of the indigo buntings a couple of years ago, I was on Nantucket with you, and these little guys, they fly in, they get to your bird feeders and water because they're just exhausted. So this is a great time for people who have bird feeders out to keep an eye out for them.
Well, these are all trans-Gulf migrants. So they're like these indigo buntings, lots of the warblers, tanagers, flycatchers. They will be leaving the Yucatan Peninsula, sticking out into the Gulf of Mexico at sunset. And they come across, the wind is then south, and they start across the Gulf Coast. And if the wind stays that way, that's fine. It blows them right up into the middle of North America where they want to be. But if you've looked at a weather map recently, like the one I was just looking at this morning, it shows a strong area of cold frontal systems with a lot of rain coming up to smash up against this southerly airflow that's coming out of Mexico, and those fronts cause all sorts of really, well, it's the cold and the, you know, they not only do they cause tornadoes and torrential downpours, but the winds, they tend to ground the birds, or the birds can feel the low pressure coming, and they fly, they try to avoid it, and they will often take a route that will take them hundreds of miles from where they want to go. So fronts like that can, in other words, like I was watching my bird feeder on Nantucket a few springs ago at noon, and there was nothing. All of a sudden, a band of thunderstorms came through. It was over by 3 in the afternoon. I looked out at the feeder where there had been nothing, and there were 8 indigo buntings, bright blue. There were 4 rose-breasted grosbeaks, Baltimore Orioles. I mean, they literally had dropped out of the sky, and clearly they were associated with that system. So what we hope for, at least, you know, because it's such a it's such a great thing when it happens for the birders. I'm not sure how much the birds are enjoying this. Is to really pay attention. And in fact, you don't want really nice weather in the spring because it just sort of lets things go right along at a normal flow. So a couple periods of days of bad weather and then a nice clearing system. And there's just likely to be birds all over the place.
Vern, is it unusual to see that on the? I know Nantucket's sort of sitting out there, you know. Will we see the same things on some of the Cape bird feeders in the vineyard?
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, the Cape is actually better. It's much better. And of course, places like the Outer Cape, but even the Inner Cape. I mean, any of the Elizabeth Islands, Falmouth, the birds are moving over generally a broad area, and when they arrive, they look down and they look for the best looking habitat. So. Things, yards that are greener than other yards. Often in the spring, the birds will go into downtown areas on the islands because those are the hot spots, protected from the wind. The trees or their vegetation is a few weeks ahead, emergent-wise. And, you know, otherwise, the cold south shore, they're not out there. So there's little microclimates in the spring. Find a place particularly good are small wetlands that are surrounded by these black willows. And the black willows are the ones that have, like, the little pussy willows, the little catkins that come out.
Yeah.
And they're already flowering on the Cape. Well, those are the first catkins, and those attract the first insects and nectar. And those are always, like, if I was going birding today over there, I would go to different wetland areas and check those, because that's where you'll see the most land birds.
It's Bird News. We're talking with ornithologist Vernon Locks. If you have a bird question or a story for us, we'd love to hear from you. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so ospreys are back. We've been seeing them on the nests, and it looks like, at this point, have they laid eggs yet, or is that still
to
come?
Well, I don't know. You have many nests near you?
Yeah, well, you know, the one over by Surf Drive Beach that's so close to the road there that hasn't had any for a couple, you know, they have. There's a pair there now this year, and there's another pair also by the bike path there. There's a pole. And
Normally out on most places, the Vineyard, Nantucket, by April 15th, the established pairs that are going to be nesting are firmly entrenched and egg-laying. This year, at least, we had such a rainy spring. Last June was the rainiest June on record, that we had the nesting ospreys had a very terrible nest success rate, and many, many ospreys did not fledge young at all. It was a very bad breeding year. And when you have a bad breeding year, the adults sort of linger around, and then they depart early to wander around before they head to South America. And I think what happens is this year they came back, and it's musical osprey poles. It's all, you know, it's all new partners.
Mm.
I've been watching what I thought were established pairs at several poles with a two, you know, mate, and they've even been copulating and mating, and then all of a sudden a third or a fourth of it, as many as five ospreys come in, and they'll fly around and chase each other all day. So I don't know if they're still trying to determine who the alpha female is going to be and the alpha male, but it seems like there's some sort of badness going on.
Hmm.
This is not what you would hope. You like them to settle right down, be incubating, and be ready. So
what happened, do you think, is maybe some birds came back earlier, and then the ones who normally, or the second birds come in, they say, hey, that's my pole, no, it's mine?
Well, I think all of that happened, and I think other young birds, normally ospreys don't come back until their third year from the tropics, and so you've got new birds. And if they're pair bond, if they weren't able to fledge young last year, I think it's something happens, and they maybe go to a different location or they look for a new mate. So there's a lot of uncertainty in the osprey world. So anybody that can see your nest or gets to watch one regularly really will be in for a much busier year than normal, because there's a lot of what I would consider atypical, abnormal behavior going on.
And that would be a great thing for people to keep notes on. So that would really
interesting. But you would have to really, you know, lay the time in looking at a spotting scope and watch what happens on that nest.
Yeah.
And right now is when it's really happening. This will all be sorted out. I have seen a couple of them get very aggressive with the other ones, trying to drive them off. And I envision if this sort of stuff keeps going on for the next week, that one of the either the dominant male or female will get very aggressive, and you may see ospreys start really hurting each other.
Why won't they just move to another pole?
Well, it's because why do men fight?
Why? You're right. It's hard to understand.
Right. It's right.
Oh, we got an email from Pat who says, hi, Mindy and Vern. This is Pat from Dennis, who keeps bringing updates from the great nest at the Eastham Orleans Rotary. I called last summer to report a pair of juveniles who were practice nesting, bringing and dropping sticks and getting to know each other, as it were. I remember that. Sure enough, shabby looking as it is, they are back and making a go of a new nest. It grows every day, and I'm pretty much fascinated. Look up Jones Road for a wonderful cul-de-sac to sit and watch the show, both nests. Thanks for your great shows. Thanks, Pat, for that update.
Yeah, and hopefully that sounds like they're well along. And if you keep watching there, hopefully they'll be copulating and egg-laying very shortly.
Yeah. How long before the baby ospreys will hatch?
Depends when the eggs are laid.
Mm-hmm. But how long is that?
Of course, once they lay the egg, ospreys and all birds of prey begin incubation immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't, like if it was a robin, the robin lays an egg. Well, the female might not lay another egg for 2 days, so she won't. So that first one, she'll just sort of keep warm, but not getting until the full clutch. Then they incubate so that they hatch synchronously.
Oh.
An osprey lays the egg. The female starts incubating immediately. She may not lay another egg for 3 days, and she'll incubate that. And typically around here, they lay three eggs. So the The first egg has a 9-day advantage. And when that chick hatches, it's going to be bigger, stronger, and the first one to get fed. And the adult will feed it. It depends. Nestlings depends on the amount of food they get. But they're generally in the nest about a month, 31, 32 days, before they are sufficiently grown. And then they stay in the nest. The adults will feed them. But hopefully in a year with a lot of fish, all the osprey young make it. But you can imagine when the little chick hatches and the other one is 9 days older and has been eating lots and lots of fish, that if there are food shortages and things go bad, well, it's been going on for millions of years. The bigger one eats the little one.
Oh, boy.
That's the way it is with hawks. Yeah, it's not fun, but it's a system that has gotten them to where they are. And hope most years that doesn't happen.
Right.
But it can happen. So the moral of that story is you want to be the first egg to hatch.
You want to be the first one, yeah. You want to be the oldest, the eldest. And so if we're seeing the female sitting on the nest now, that likely means there's an egg in there, at least.
Well, right? I think they should be starting to lay eggs right now.
Okay.
Yep, and the females should start. And you'll also notice, well, the ospreys out here I've been watching were not spending the night on the nest yet because they didn't have eggs, and I think there was some worry about snowy owls coming and attacking them.
Right. That was my next question. What's going on? You sent some great photos of a little encounter between a snowy owl and an osprey.
I did not take those.
Yeah, but you said, tell us who took them and tell us about the photos. I think they're still up on our website.
A gentleman named Brad Wynn, who is a shorebird expert, works at the Manomet Center for Conservation Science in Plymouth. He was taking pictures of a piping plover. He was crawling around on his belly on the beach with a 400-millimeter lens, and he heard this oyster catcher, and then all of a sudden he hears this osprey screaming, and he looks over, and there's a snowy owl standing on a big rock on the beach, like at the base of the jetty. It was, what was it called, Angel Point, I think, in Mattapoisett, or Angelic Point. Anyway, he just happened to have the camera, and he was just the right distance away. Well, this osprey came in and dive-bombed and stukaed, and just the owl was barking and throwing its wings up, and you got a really nice interaction between the owl. And the owl, of course, I mean, the osprey doesn't want the owl near its nesting pole because owls and ospreys don't like each other, and the owl could possibly eat the adult and certainly would eat the young. Mm-hmm. So he made a great effort to drive it off. The owl stood his ground, and then eventually they disinterested it. But later in the day, the owl moved, and he hasn't come back.
Yeah. What a great shots, though. Those photos were really awesome.
I've been hoping to see that all spring, and I have yet to do it, because there are snowy owls are finally starting to thin. They are getting much harder to find. I know somebody that found a couple yesterday, but like a few days before, he found 7, and in the same place there are only 2. I was out birding most of the weekend and did not see a snowy owl.
Huh. So they're heading north again, you think?
Yeah. They're going to start north. It gets too hot for them.
Right.
They got too many feathers.
Yeah. It's Bird News. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with ornithologist Vernon Locks, and our toll-free number for your bird comments or questions, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Of course, Vern, this time of year is a good time to see those woodcocks doing their little courting display.
So have you availed yourself of the opportunity?
I have not yet, although I did see that great video that somebody had of the little woodcock dancing in their yard.
Uh-huh.
That was pretty interesting.
I had a small group out last week with these, and the woodcock started just at dark. There weren't many calling this night, and they came down and paint. I was able to get to I have these new lights that I use on my bicycle that are quite amazing, high tech, and they lit the woodcock up, and we were able to get them in the telescope, and It was a life-changing experience, I think, for all who saw them. They had no idea anything that cool or unique was going on every night, right? A mile from where they live.
Right.
So anybody listening to this going, what is an American woodcock and why is this so cool? Well, you need to find out about it. You need to go on a woodcock prowl. There's a lot of great areas. The Cape's loaded with them. If that doesn't work, come to Nantucket, and I'll take you on one.
Okay,
Dan, the Linda Loring Nature Foundation.
Yeah, there's a lot of places. Crane Wildlife is another great place, right?
That does. Crane's great, mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people that would, in fact, call the Cape Cod Bird Club. There's anybody mm-hmm. that's a member and is a birder probably goes out on woodcock. So these woodcock are these bizarre-looking shorebirds about the size of a robin with a long beak. During the daytime, they just rest on the leaf litter in the floor. They're nocturnal. So just as it starts getting dark, they fly up out of the woods, out into these fields, and they'll land in ball fields, Crane Wildlife Area, any of the state forests that have open fields. Actually, they go into a whole wide variety of habitats, but the more open, the better. Because the males, right at dusk and dawn, are going to put on their courtship display. So they come and they make funny noises. The outer feathers on each wing, their outer three feathers, are specially modified. And they have quills on the outside that actually make noise when they fly. And this is all about their display flight. They sort of make this twittering. It's not.
Yeah, we can hear it. Dan's got the sound. Go ahead, Dan.
Oh, cool. That's what we call painting on the ground.
There's the feathers. So if you're walking along and you hear that, take a look.
Well, when you hear that, you probably won't see it because it's dark and the bird is whipping along in the air and he's actually side-slipping back to earth. They go into this long ascending spiral, and then they come down, and they hit the ground again, and then the male goes, bang, bang, and he bobs his head up and down. And if you can get a light on him, they're not shy, and the light doesn't bother them. There's a big eye shine. And then you can use binoculars. You can actually get a pretty good look at one.
Yeah, they're good.
And it's very exciting. It's fun. I know people from age 80 to age 3 who all think it's the coolest thing they've ever seen.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah.
So, yeah, I would encourage people to get out there and check this out.
Check it out.
It's worthwhile.
Yeah. All right. Carol's calling from Dennis. Good morning, Carol.
Hi. Hi. Good morning. I have a question, and it's on a birdhouse. Our neighbor, who is very, very handy and a lovely gentleman, gave us a martin house, and it's gorgeous. It's white, and it's got beautiful green trim, and there's no interest in it whatsoever. This is our second or third year with it. No tenants. And the problem, I think, I could be wrong, but Vern will tell us, is it's made from a composite. It's made from what they call Isaac. It's a plastic composite, and they use it on buildings and so forth so that it won't rot. But I think that the birds would rather have, you know, a natural product. I could be wrong.
What do you think, Vern?
Well, I've got a bunch of questions for you first. What town do you live in?
I live in Dennis.
Okay.
On the north side.
As far as I know, there are no nesting purple martins in Dennis.
But wouldn't another bird be interested in a birdhouse?
In a martin house? Martin houses are specifically designed, right size, shape, and yes, starlings will use them. European science, but you don't want, you really, martin things are just so specific and everything has to be right.
Mm-hmm.
Do you live along the edge of a marsh?
No, we live on the north side of Dennis. It's close to 6A.
Right.
On Black Ball Hill.
Okay.
And,
I've had purple martins nesting 4 times on Cape Cod. When I used to try, I lived there a long time and put boxes up. There are currently 2 colonies of purple martins doing quite well on Cape Cod,
mm-hmm.
and they're being heavily managed. Mary Kelleher, who lives in Mashpee, is one. She's been putting up these special martins gourd boxes over at a couple of the golf courses,
uh-huh.
and they've been having great success. What the big problem for purple martins here is they need a lot of mosquitoes to eat.
I see.
And they really need to be in the open. They need to be either on, like, Sandy Neck Marsh or a whole bunch of marshes on the south side.
Uh-huh.
They have
you done anything special regarding the material? because...
I think you could put the best purple martin house in the world, or three of them with different materials where you live, and you're still not going to get purple martins.
Okay.
It's the location.
Mm. Okay. What about other birdhouses made?
I don't know. Your material actually sounds like it would work. Because purple martins down where they nest in huge numbers along the Gulf Coast and down in southern New Jersey and places will literally nest in anything.
Yeah.
I've seen them nesting in plastic. I mean, things you wouldn't think would work.
Uh-huh.
So it sounds like he did a nice piece of engineering on this, and it would work. He just has had no
acres. You know what, Carol? Maybe you want... Those birdhouses are expensive. Maybe you can sell that one to somebody who's got some in their area. And then what can Carol put up? What kind of a birdhouse would get some action in her?
Well, where she is, she would get nesting tree swallows. You would get white-breasted nuthatches, tufted titmice. You might get eastern bluebirds.
I have three bluebirds that come and eat at the feeder, but they don't stick around. But they're here. They're
beautiful. You've got bluebirds already. So you're in a pretty wooded spot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right, you're not going to get martins. I would suggest talk to the neighbor who made it for you and say, thank you very much, but let's put it somewhere where it's going to work.
Uh-huh.
Maybe call Mary Kelleher, who lives in Mashpee. She's in the phone book, and Mary could help you out.
Maybe some bluebird boxes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you get a bluebird, tree swallows. There's lots of interesting stuff that I use boxes there.
Yeah.
I love black-capped chickadees that nest in the yard. Downy woodpeckers. Mm-hmm. And all the birds feed their young insects, so they're all beneficial.
Yeah. Carol, thanks.
Okay.
I didn't mean to burst your bubble.
Take care of your ribs.
Yeah. Carol, let us know what you end up putting up, what you end up having in your yard.
Okay.
Okay, thanks, Carol, for the phone call. Carl is calling from Falmouth. Hi, Carl.
Oh, hi. How are you doing?
Good.
Good.
Good. Hey, Bert, I remember a show you did over the winter about bird feeders, and you were talking about how important it is if you set up a bird feeder to keep it stocked through the winter because the birds acclimate to it, and that if you end up just being sort of a fair-weather bird feeder in the summer, that then they come back to an empty feeder, and they end up not being able to find what they had acclimated to. So my wife just went and picked up a bird feeder, and now I'm paralyzed that if we don't commit to this year-round, I'll be doing cruel things to the birds. How significant is it that we keep a feeder stocked year-round?
Well, you don't have to do it year-round.
Okay.
You don't have, in fact, many people, I often stop in the summer just because I get disgusted at feeding certain birds, and it's kind of messy, and they don't need it.
Oh, okay.
So, in fact, I would know, like right now, if you're feeding right now, it's very exciting because the resident birds are here. There's lots of migrants. And over the next few weeks, all kinds of cool birds that are going to be breeding further north might pop in and visit. But then, you can stop feeding Memorial Day weekend or the week before even.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah, you don't need to feed all summer. And then if you're going to start up again in the fall, I might start putting seed out again the last week of September, the first week of October.
Mm, but if we keep it through the summer, should we feel like we need to keep it through the winter as well?
No. Some people. Oh, are you just here for the summer?
No. We're year round.
Yeah. You can feed it for the summer, but the difference, like in the summer, you're going to have goldfinches, you're going to have house finches. You're going to have red-winged blackbirds and some of the stuff. And you're going to get lots. Once the young birds fledge, the adults will bring the babies over to show them the ropes of bird feeding. And that can be kind of funny and stuff. But also, sometimes you'll get flocks of house sparrows and brown-headed cowbirds and all kinds of birds that start. I really don't like seeing out my window. And plus, it's expensive.
Yeah, it is expensive.
In the summer, it's really for your entertainment because the birds don't need the food. Mm. But if I'm starting up October 1st and I build some brush piles and get the feeder set, then I know any birds, any migrants that come and stay there will be with me through the winter unless they get eaten by a predator.
Mm. Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So if I was starting up in the fall, then I'd feel like I would definitely want to keep it going.
Yeah.
Right. If you start in the fall, you're committing through the spring.
Yeah. Gotcha.
You could fill it up for a week in the summer and then let it get empty or that kind of stuff. But
yeah.
I just
don't have to be as committed in the summer.
Right, in the summer they're not. Right, there's plenty of other food.
Yeah, Carl, thanks for the phone call. Good luck
Thank
with that. Bert, let me ask you, because I know a lot of people like to put the hummingbird feeders out. When do you start doing that?
Today.
Today? Wow. When do the hummingbirds start coming back?
Well, there's a little, if you go on Google and just Google ruby-throated hummingbirds, the first thing that'll pop up is this website that you can click on, and it shows you where all the ruby-throated hummingbirds are coming up the East Coast.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
I haven't looked at it in 10 days, but they were already in Virginia and southern New Jersey. And I've had hummingbirds on this date in Massachusetts. So there are two hummingbirds hanging outside my doors here. Hummingbird feeders, no hummingbirds.
Right.
But yeah, no, now is the time. You could actually get a hummingbird, and when you get one, please let us know.
Yeah, and also, what do you
and
put
you
in?
You can report them to this website, which is very cool, too. Yeah. And then it gives you, like, a map of them coming across the Gulf of Mexico. And then as they hit Georgia, it's quite fascinating reading.
Yeah. For what do you put in the feeders? Because I know there's been some kind of debate over whether that you use that red dye stuff or not. Or
No. Well, the red dye stuff isn't good. You, basically, the hummingbird feeder plastic or whatever's on it, you want to have as much red on it as you can. But I think the, some people, well, like Trish, boils it all. She uses four parts water, one part sugar.
Okay.
And I actually sometimes when I make it get a little more generous for the hummingbirds and go more like three parts water and one, but they think that's too syrupy and not right.
Okay.
Everybody, gotcha. I figure, what the heck? Give them a little extra sugar.
They like it.
Well, that's what I would think, but maybe it doesn't work as well. I don't know.
We're talking with ornithologist Vernon Locks. Our toll-free number, if you have a bird story or question, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And the ruby-throated hummingbirds are really primarily the only. Other hummingbirds are very rare here, right?
Right. The only hummingbirds known to breed in eastern North America are all ruby-throats. What we've discovered is, since with the advent of digital photography and catching it, is that there's many more species of hummingbirds in the western U.S., and then as you go south, countries like Ecuador, which is the size of Colorado, has 130 different species of hummingbirds.
Wow.
They're all dimorphic, which means the males and females look different, and the young look different. So just there's 1,000 different-looking hummingbirds in one little place, which is amazing, and they're very hard to see.
Yeah.
So, in the fall, a lot of these little green and gray hummingbirds are turning out to be western birds, like the Rufous hummingbird breeds all the way in Alaska, and probably any hummingbird here after September 20th is more likely a Rufous hummingbird than a ruby-throat.
Huh, interesting.
So, but we just have to be able to prove it, and now with the digital cameras, if you can get pictures of the shape of their tail and their wing feathers, we can actually separate them.
Wow. Where do the Rufous hummingbirds nest? Where would they be nesting around here? Ruby throats, yeah.
Ruby throats nest in a wide variety of. They're actually pretty common in most places on Cape Cod. Most of the nests I found have been about 15 feet off the ground in oak trees. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the nest is impossibly small.
Yeah.
Like, think the size of a quarter.
Wow.
And it's decorated. It's built. It's lined with lichens, gray lichens, and it blends in perfectly. The only way you're really ever going to find one is if you've got one nesting close, or you just see a female, looks like she has something in her mouth. Keep watching her, because the hummingbird nest is so small that the hummingbird doesn't really fit in it. So when she's incubating on the nest, her head and her tail are sticking out still.
Huh.
So you can actually see her on the nest.
Yeah.
Okay. And everything about them is impossibly small and
so
wonderful.
Cute. Yeah, exactly. Harry is calling from Chilmark. Hi, Harry.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Good.
I just have a quick hummingbird story. I've been living in the same place for about 7 years, and every year I put a hummingbird feeder out, and in the spring, I usually do a sailboat trip. I bring a boat from the Caribbean up north, and I am gone for a few weeks, and I usually get home the end of April, beginning of May, and I walk in my door, and the first thing I see is a ruby-throated hummingbird hovering right where I usually have the feeder every year.
He's waiting for
and
you.
Someone told me it's probably the same birds coming back year after year after year, or they're young and feeding on the same feeder, but they always just sit right there like, put out the feeder, put out the feeder.
Hmm. That's right. So I hope you put out the feeder.
Oh, I do, religiously.
Yeah, good.
And I, like I said, it's usually the towards the end of April, beginning of May, but now that you said that, I'll put it out right away.
Yeah, I think so. You might have to have somebody put it up even if you're not there, if you're late getting back.
Yeah, exactly.
Because this is just about the time. And whereabouts in Chilmark are you?
North Road, right across from Grey Rock Pike.
That's all that area is very good, the moraine with a lot of trees, and there's a lot of ruby-throated hummingbirds there.
And sometimes we probably have three males and two or three females at a time hovering around, fighting around the feeder.
Nice.
You know, making their usual ruckus.
Yeah, it's funny as you go. I used to have a house up on Prince Edward Island, which is another 900 miles north of the Cape and Islands.
Yeah.
And it's colder and nastier, but ruby-throated hummingbirds get all the way up there, and you would think up in the cold. Anyway, it turns out they're like, you put a feeder up there in late May or June, and you'll have 40 ruby-throated hummingbirds.
Wow.
That'd
and be something.
It's amazing. Well, apparently, they're such important pollinators in all the blueberries, raspberries, and there's less insects.
Right.
Less wasp and stuff.
Right.
That the hummingbirds have been able to, they increase in density because there's more food available for them. With the insects and the nectar, there's less competition from the various other pollinators that are found further south, which is a research project for somebody.
Yeah.
Anyway, pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah.
They're amazing. So they do return to the same spot, though. Just like someone said, they go to Costa Rica or something, then come right back to my house every year.
Yeah, it's very likely the same bird.
Yeah.
Cool. All right.
Harry, thanks for sharing that story. Appreciate that.
Hummingbirds are only found in North and South America.
Yeah.
And so the Brits and the Africans, people from around the world will take a trip just to the Americas just to see the only bird in the world that can fly upside down, backwards. I mean, hummingbirds are the coolest.
They are. Harry, thanks for the call.
All right, take it easy.
Let's talk to Mary, who's calling from Bass River. Hi, Mary.
Hi, good morning.
It's a beauty.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead, Mary.
Okay, hi. Hi, Vern.
Hi.
I have a question about Baltimore Orioles. I live on Bass River, right close to the Bass River golf course, and I know I've seen them there. And are they here yet?
They're not supposed to be here yet. There may be a couple.
Okay.
But they will be arriving. They almost invariably on the Cape and Islands arrive on a southwest wind between May 3rd and 10th.
Okay.
That's when
I'm a little early for the Orioles.
Mm-hmm. Right. But okay.
My hummingbird feeder.
Mm-hmm. Say that again?
I'm right on target with my hummingbird feeder, though.
Yeah, but I wouldn't mind, you know, if you were to cut up an orange or two and stick it outside.
You never know.
You might get a rosebreast. You might get the early oriole that says, thank you, Mary.
Okay. I will be doing that then. I got it out. I'm taking it down because it's going to rain today, but I'll put it up tomorrow.
All right.
Because this rain may actually have some birds on the back side of it.
Right. Oh, good, good.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Enjoy your program.
Thanks.
I follow you faithfully.
Thanks, Mary.
Okay.
Thanks for the phone call. Bird News with ornithologist Vernon Locks, 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with ornithologist Vernon Locks, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We've got a couple of emails here. Vern, this is a message from a listener. It says, last spring, some neighbor removed an osprey nest from their roof. Now the birds are back, and we are wondering what we should do about this situation. Are folks allowed to remove nests or not?
Boy, I would never remove a nest, and I would encourage getting it built up there. But I don't know the answer. What town is this in?
You know, they didn't say. But will the birds? I mean, since there's no nest there, it's Woods Hole. They're saying Woods Hole.
It's Woods Hole, and geez, well, I I would, you know, I think you'd be the talk of the neighborhood having an osprey nest on your roof.
Yeah.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
So I actually don't understand the motivation to take it down. I would help. I'd go up and build a platform and have, like, osprey calls and say, "Osprey's welcome. Yeah. Free herring."
Okay. So we don't know the answer. Okay. Then we've got.
I don't know. I mean, I know you can remove power lines, but still, I don't get it.
All right. So we got another email from Ann who says, would a red-breasted, huge woodpecker that is excavating an oak in the vicinity of my bird feeders and houses be scaring off the smaller birds by its presence?
No. A red-breasted, huge woodpecker. I wonder what in the world that could be.
I don't know.
Since red-bellied woodpeckers don't really have a red breast, red-headed woodpeckers do, but no, woodpeckers would be attracting other birds because woodpeckers are so feisty and noisy that they actually seem to attract other birds because the woodpecker will be alert and will alert them to any danger. And especially if it's building a nest, it's going to be even more attentive. So even though woodpeckers are just crazy. They get busy this time of year. And I can see how they might annoy some people, but I think they're terrific. Yeah. And we need more woodpeckers.
Anne also sent a picture of an electric meter camouflage birdhouse condo. She says created by Carpenter David, complete with copper flashing and landing aerial. She says she doesn't care who moves in. And we're going to put some, I guess Jenny will put some pictures up on our Facebook page of that. All right. And then we got Sarah, who you know, who is one of your coworkers, I think, over at Linda Loring Nature Foundation.
Oh, great.
She says she hopes you're doing okay after your adventure yesterday. She says, just wanted to give you an update. It looks like the osprey pair on the pole at the Linda Loring Nature Foundation has settled down. They were copulating just a minute ago. Hopefully they'll be on eggs soon. Also, there was a report of an albino or partial albino robin on Meadowview Drive yesterday.
Nice. Well, yeah. Thank you, Sarah.
All right.
That's good.
Joan is calling from South Wellfleet. Good morning, Joan.
Good morning.
Hi.
For taking my call. Hi.
Sure.
I've lived at the same house in South Wellfleet for about 20 years, and the first year we moved here, I woke up in the middle of the night. I heard this noise. I thought there was an animal in my house. And there was a whippoorwill on my stoop. And it seems like over the years, you know, they've continued to be in this area. But last year it seemed like there wasn't as much activity. There was some, but not as much. And I'm wondering what's happening with the whippoorwills, if anything.
Well, what's happening with whippoorwills is, since I've been watching birds for some 40-odd years, they have been steadily decreasing all over their known range and all over North America. Whippoorwills are nocturnal flying machines that depend on large nocturnal moths for the bulk of their food. They actually fly around at night with their beaks open, and they have these long rictal bristles, and they're able to catch them. Well, because of DDT use in the 50s and 40s, large moth populations are also not doing well pretty much anywhere in the eastern half of the country. And add to this the development pressure, the vacation homes, the feral cats, they're ground nesting birds. There was some gentlemen doing a study on Otis Air Force Base for the past few years. They were misnetting the birds. They actually put transmitters on them so they could find them. And then they were locating the nest during the day. And they're a nest. When I say nest, it should be like quote-unquote nest. It's just they basically lay one or two eggs in the leaves. There is no nest. They don't leave a scent mark. They roll around, and then the young hatch. And very odd. But because of the prevalence of skunks, opossums, raccoons, they have just been dwindling and dwindling to where whippoorwill is now a very rare bird on the Outer Cape. The only place I know to hear them actually is to go over to Marconi Swamp on a late night in May and hope it's not too windy and hope I hear one. So I'd say you've been very lucky to enjoy them all these years, and I hope they continue to hang on there. But it's a bird that is slowly decreasing, and it seems I really don't know what we can do to reverse the trend.
Yeah.
So I hope that's not too depressing, but that's the way I see it.
Yeah, I do enjoy them, and it is a little depressing, but I'll keep my ears open, and hopefully I'll hear, you know, more whippoorwills this summer.
Yeah,
I hope so. I hope you hear lots. And then, have you ever heard of Chuck Will's widow?
I haven't, but I have a dear friend who's a major birder, and she has them over at her home in East Orleans.
Hmm. Right, or she lives over by Pochett somewhere.
That she lives right by Pochett.
She lives by Pochett. She's heard that bird calling a few times, yeah. Because that's a bird you could also get. We've had them calling a few times up at the Cedar Swamp at Marconi.
Mm-hmm.
And any place that has whippoorwills these days could, in fact, have Chuck Will's widows, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they just, they're like, chirp, 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 different. Instead of whippoorwill, they're chirp, chirp, chirp.
I love it. And they go faster and faster and faster. And I notice that sometimes you can hear like a little clucking sound.
If you're close enough, you can get another part of the vocalization that you can't hear.
Well, Joan, you're observant, isn't she?
Yeah, well, she must be. You must have been very close. Plus,
well,
it is one of the
right neatest, on my stoop.
It's one of the neatest
like
sounds
on my stoop. So,
So Joan, if that happens this year, I want you to go get a pretty cool tape recorder, or get Brian Morris from the radio station to come over with his recording and try to record the bird calling on the stoop.
Yeah, if you have a cell phone, you can do it with you.
I actually had it as my on my message machine. That's the first thing you would hear is the whippoorwills.
Oh, yeah, I want your phone number then.
I'm sorry?
That's awesome.
Yeah, Joan, if you want to give your phone number to Jenny for Vern to talk about that, we'll have Jenny pick up the phone. So hold on, Joan.
Okay.
We've got an email from Sally who says she lives in Harwich, a mile from exit 10 off Route 6. Turkeys were here this weekend, the males displaying their fancy feathers and the females strutting ahead of them. Yesterday, we noticed a female with feathers of a light buff color, similar to the leaves she was rolling in. My husband says her feathers were tan. We have never seen a turkey with feathers that color. Is she normal or is she ill?
Oh, well, Freddie, I think all turkeys are ill. No, the turkey's normal. It sounds like those feathers may have gotten stained from the tannins in the oaks.
Mm.
And there is quite a lot of variation in turkey plumages anyway.
Yeah. When we talked about that red-breasted huge woodpecker, could it be a red-bellied woodpecker?
Yeah, it very well could be. But when they say red-bellied, it's just a hint of red on the belly of the male that's very hard to see.
All right. Jenny said they sent a photo, so we'll put that photo up.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, well, then we'll know in a second. I'm not a Facebook guy.
I know. We'll email it. We'll put it up on our website and the Facebook page.
Put it somewhere where I can see it. Yeah. Okay.
And there's some other listeners who say the same thing, Vern. They're not on Facebook.
Oh, that's good.
Either,
You're not alone.
You're not alone there.
That's good.
All right, so since we had that question earlier about the osprey nests, now we're going to see lots of little nests and things, and once the birds are gone, is it okay to take them? I mean, most birds don't come back and use those same nests again, right?
Well, what are we talking about?
Well, you get a finch, a robin, a cardinal, any of the nests.
You know, land birds, all the land birds are only going, a cavity nesting bird, in other words, in a nest box or a woodpecker hole, they will reuse the nest. Something will reuse that nest hole.
Oh, really?
And an osprey nest pole, of course, will be made as long as it doesn't blow down. It could be used for hundreds of years.
Hmm.
And bald eagles. Most birds, though, like all the little songbirds, they do not reuse the nest.
Okay.
Because birds are most vulnerable during the nesting season. Think about a bird that's, what does a bird do to get away from trouble? It flies.
Right.
So if it's stuck to a nest with eggs, the urge for it when something's coming near, the flight response is big. And so, here comes a cat coming by the area. How long do you wait before you fly?
Mm-hmm.
Do you let the cat, if you wait too long, the cat eats you. If you take off at the right time, the cat eats the eggs, you lose the nest, but you live to lay another day. So all those things figure into. So anyway, and then also once the nest is done, because of all the noise that was there, the bird poop, the smell, there's a scent trail as well. So there's no future. They find virtually all the nests get found, but hopefully not until the little birds are gone.
Right. Well, as I told you, I've had that, I have different wreaths on my porch, and the house finch always comes back it'll build a nest in my wreath, and then it'll build a nest on top of the wreath, but I can clear those old ones out.
Right.
Because they'll make new ones. Okay. I guess that was my question. Yeah. And as you know, I saw some interesting first birds for me.
Cool.
When I was out west, I saw a Steller's jay and went, what the heck is that? beautiful bluebird. And then the scrub jay, I was out in California, and wow. But they don't have our blue jays.
Nope. That's like the Europeans come over here, and I think the European jay is shocking, and they just, the Brits and the people from Holland just go goo-goo over blue jays.
I can see why.
They think it's the coolest, like, wow, we are so lucky. We wish we had blue jays at our, you know, that's the most beautiful bird, which is, it's all relative, I guess.
Yeah, it is.
That's true.
Yeah. We didn't talk about the European shorebird that was seen on Nantucket.
Yes, this past weekend I had a bunch of visiting dignitaries over on Nantucket to help out an advisory board for the Linda Loring Nature Foundation. To advise us on some of our birding festival and some of our birding programs. And there were a lot of high-powered guys. And, of course, they wanted to see some birds before the meeting. So just before we go into the meeting, we duck off. We go to the edge of Long Pond on Matticat Road. And we were looking for a bird, a tufted duck, a Eurasian duck that had been hanging around. Well, we didn't find that, but we all get out of the car and look behind us, and there's a shorebird standing right on the mound. I go, oh, look, our first graded yellowlegs of the spring, FOY, first of year bird. And we all just, and then, so I said, I grabbed my telescope and put it on, and somebody else gets their binoculars look, and we look at it and go, oh, my God, it's a ruff. It's not a graded yellowlegs. It's a bird that has never been seen on Nantucket in 75 years.
Wow.
And it's a rare, in fact, it was a new bird for most of them in Massachusetts, and the only one in Massachusetts in many years. We took pictures. And anyway, we were quite pleased to have this Asiatic stray. These things breed all over the top of Europe and Asia, wintering in Africa and Australia. So when I was a kid birding back in the 60s, they used to show up more often, but really rare bird. In fact, it was the first one anyone alive had ever seen on Nantucket. Hmm.
And do they look a little bit like a greater yellowlegs, obviously?
Well, it's a sandpiper. They're really an odd sandpiper. They're sort of about the size of a greater yellowlegs, but they have like a plump belly. They look like they have a pot belly and a funny rounded bill, and they're dimorphic. The males turn into these huge, they get all puffed up and they turn black, orange, white, and they go north on the tundra and they just display these courtship patterns and flights in a lek. And all the female ruffs gather on just like prairie chickens or something. Hmm. And so the females are all pretty bland, and they're standing around, and all the different colored males are dancing and trying to win the affections of the females in a lekking system, which is very unusual. And so we think this, we're not sure if this was a female. It was still all bland and brown, but it was pretty cool.
Yeah. We got less
I managed to get a bunch of pictures. If you're interested, I might send them over.
Oh, yeah, send them over. Sure, yeah, we'll put those up. Just about 30 seconds left, but we should just kind of, baby birds are going to be around soon, and, you know, people are always worried when they see one, but I guess don't worry, Mom is watching them, right? Just best thing is to do is leave them alone?
The best advice is to get away.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, I mean, you can't, there's so many little birds, although that shouldn't be a big problem until later on. Hopefully late May and June is the month.
Okay.
But there are already, like, morning doves are sitting on eggs. There'll be those young birds all the time. Sadly, brown-headed cowbirds are back in numbers, and
mm-mm.
They're one of my least favorite because they are sneaking around trying to lay their eggs in other birds' nests.
Yeah.
They're brood parasites.
Not we don't welcome them.
No, that's not a good way. They actually hurt the population of our small birds.
All right. Ornithologist Vernon Locks joined us for Bird News. Vern, take care of your broken rib.
Right,
glad you're okay.
Thank you. I'll have a great rest of April. I'll see you soon.
Okay. Thanks. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.